As background, of course, there's a need to determine the likely effect of global warming on open field agriculture, as well as on a lot of different natural ecosystems. Back in 2005, I derived at an equation to predict the energy requirements that would take to do infrared heating to provide an incremental warming of plant canopies. However, I didn't do a very good job of handling buoyancy effects in the warming, and as many of you know, the forecasts or projections are up to about 11 degrees C of warming up at the high latitudes. So this amount of warming is quite a bit beyond just an incremental degree or so, of which I know my equations can handle, or that 2005 equations. Thus, there's a need to predict the likely costs and performance of such infrared heating systems for experiments that are warming on the order of 10 degrees C or so. So the objectives are to derive equations to predict the canopy temperatures with and without the extra thermal radiation from infrared heaters, then compare the performance with measured performance of infrared heater systems, and then I'm going to be looking at data from wheat experiment that we did at Maricopa, Arizona, hot cereal experiment. Gary Wall will be talking a lot more about that in the next paper. And I should mention that I'm also going to be talking about a soy face experiment in Urbana, Illinois, and the PHACE face experiment, which is prairie heating and CO2 experiment at Cheyenne, Wyoming. And there are more authors, Carl Bernacki, Jack Morgan, David Smith, on my talk here that I didn't get into the abstract because I'm including their data in my presentation. This is what the hexagonal heater array looks like that I've designed using these infrared heaters arranged over a hexagonal pattern, and it's over wheat, and I'll divert a little bit and point out to you that you notice underneath the heaters that the wheat is headed out in this particular day, and around it it hasn't, so that gives you a little idea of the rate, the way that the warming does in fact accelerate the development of the wheat crop. Since I developed that system, why a lot of people thought, hey, this is a good way to do it, so a lot of my time is being spent helping a whole lot of other folks get started, and then it's kind of interesting that there are now about 17 groups around the world that are using this kind of heating system to do experiments on both agricultural and natural ecosystems. But anyway, this is the steps then that I want to try to use then to extend the range of heating up to higher temperatures. The first thing is to do is to calculate the canopy temperature of a reference plot with no heaters or just dummy heaters out there. Then simply set the canopy temperature of the heated plot to whatever degree of desired warming that there's going to be, and then compute the amount of downwelling thermal radiation that's going to take to achieve that amount of heating. However, if the capacity of your heaters isn't large enough, then they have to go back and recalculate how much warming we can actually get with the size of the heaters that we've actually got out there. Now, this part ought to be easy. I've worked with Ray Jackson and other folks at the old Water Conservation Lab, and this was all solved back in 1980s, right? Well, I got into some problems with it, and as I'll tell you about a little bit here. Anyway, basically, this is the energy balance at the Earth's surface. It's often written as the net radiation is equal to sensible heat flux plus the latent heat term. And for this purposes, I'm going to ignore the soil heat flux. The net radiation can be written out in this way, where this is the solar component that's absorbed, where that's the albedo. This is sky radiation that's coming down. And then this is the additional amount of thermal radiation that will be coming down from those infrared heaters. And then this is the radiation that's being emitted up to the sky from the crop. The sensible and latent heat can be computed from this big leaf model type of thing, where this is the temperature difference, and that's the aerodynamic resistance. Similarly, the latent heat term, where the aerodynamic, or the vapor pressure difference from inside the leaves to the air above it, and then there's the aerodynamic resistance, and then the canopy resistance. The canopy resistance, of course, depends on stomatal conductance and the canopy architecture and that sort of thing. There's been a lot of work done on developing what is called a standard alfalfa crop and other things, and basically in the daytime, why RC is often around 30 seconds per meter and 200 centimeters at night, and so that's what I'm going to be using a lot of the time, although I play around with that when I want to have the crop be stressed. Back in the 80s, most recently in the textbooks, like with HAM here, we've now started, most micrometeorologists are using the Monin-Ubikoff similarity theory and coming up with this equation then for the aerodynamic resistance, which has got these psi factors in it to account for the instability of the or lack of neutrality in the profile of the temperature profile. And that's got this Monin-Ubikoff length in it that determines the stability. And the heat, sensible heat, is in that equation. And that winds up producing a lot of different wiggle in the numerical calculations that go on, and I'll get into that a little bit. Anyway, these are the two equations for the psi functions. And so anyway, for an unheated plot, we set this temperature, or the thermal radiation coming down from the heaters to zero, rearrange the equation, that's what it looked like. Now, I found the Newton-Raphson iteration doesn't work because they're oscillatory convergence problems. And so I adopted this kind of brute force method that a lot of people use, where you go back to that equation and then you start solving it with different values for the canopy temperature, wait till it changes sign, and then start stepping backwards in very small increments until finally you get it. I'm using double precision and very small changes from one iteration to the next, double precision. So I think I got a good system here, but anybody want to talk to me later about it, I'd certainly welcome some help. Now, back in the early 1980s, Martin Eck came up with this kind of a function, which uses this psi thing, and there's there's phi, and that uses the Richardson number. And the Richardson number doesn't have the sensible heat flux in it, so it doesn't have quite as much wiggle in it as the Monin-Ubikoff one does. And that's, by the way, the one that I've done most of the calculations with that I'm going to be showing you towards the end of the talk. And because I just didn't finish here, this wound up taking longer than I thought it would when I submitted the abstract. Now, at night, when there's very little wind speed out there, a lot of these equations just fall apart, and the ASHRAE, the heating and refrigerating folks, have published this equation, they say, which will work for an semi-infinite plane where you don't have any wind. And so the aerodynamic resistance is equal to the difference in temperature between the surface and the air to the third power. So anyway, in advance, I'll tell you, I was having trouble, so then I started going back. And I just picked, okay, what are the conditions for a humid night, a dry night, a humid day, a dry day, as a function of wind speed? And that's basically what we've got here, where this is the dry night, humid night, and so forth. And you can see that if you look at night, this is where the Monin-Ubikoff goes around like this, and then it starts plummeting down to really cold temperatures, much colder than anything we actually observe out in the field. So it's at this point then where that ASHRAE equation kicks in, and we wind up with canopy temperatures then that are much closer to what I actually see out there in the field. Now, if you go along for the humid daytime conditions, which are up here, why, I'm agreeing real well with either whichever system I do until I get to really the very close here, and then the one system works as pretty stable here and the other one is not. This is what the actual aerodynamic resistances are coming along here. Level one, it goes wild here at real low wind speeds, and then this is where that ASHRAE equation is kicking in. Now, the agreement on the temperatures was really close, but look what happens to the latent heat flux. What we've got here at really high wind speeds is a case where the convergence surface looks like a big flat bowl, and we're trying to get at the center of that thing, and it winds up, depending on the initial conditions as to what side of that bowl you're coming on to as to where it decides it converges. If I start off here and say that the initial condition here, we're going to start off at 10 miles an hour and just jump to it, it winds up converging to a latent heat flux that's up here. And then I start off, okay, it's 10. The next time I come around here and I say it's 9 meters per second, we wind up going this way as wind speed decreases. If I start off with 3 meters per second, it goes off in this direction. This is where I started up here in the case, or down here, where I said it was neutral when I first started as far as the profile is concerned. So I thought, well, what am I going to do here? It really makes a big difference on the latent heat flux, and that winds up changing the amount of heating that's going to take later on to change that thing. So I said, well, what I'm going to do is to take that Martin Eck thing as the initial guess at what it is, and then we'll use Mononubikoff after that. And so that's the curve then that I get using my initial guess from Martin Eck and then finishing it off with Mononubikoff. So that's the latent heat one, and the sensible one is a similar thing down here. So with all of this, here's kind of the procedure that I'm now using. I'm not done with all these calculations yet. I said it's a work in progress, but first I use Martin Eck to get close to the answer. Then I use Mononubikoff to iterate to something that I hope is more accurate. Then I compute the RA then for natural convection, i.e. no wind, and then select whichever one of these gives me the smaller value for the aerodynamic resistance. Step two, increase the temperature up to what we want it to be with warming. Step three, that's linear with the amount of heat coming or radiation coming down from the heater, so we can solve that pretty simply. And then, if necessary, go back then if you don't have enough heater capacity. This gives you a little idea of, back using the Martin Eck formulation, of how much heat it does take to do this warming. This is the heating requirement for just 1 degree C of warming versus wind. At night, you can see it doesn't take very much at all, and it goes off like that. In the daytime, if the stomates are closed, it's something like that. Of course, as the wind gets up there, it doesn't matter too much whether it's night or day. Now, if the stomates are open, it takes a lot of energy to warm that crop in the daytime, both because there's more turbulence out there and because the stomates are open. I'll skip on this one. So we come up with these equations then for how much energy it's going to take in thermal radiation to raise the thing. How much power does it take then that you have to put into the heaters to get that amount of thermal radiation down? We've done a lot of measurements, and this is the one that's fitted to the data, and this is the one then that I use for the radiation efficiency to go from thermal radiation to electrical power. I'm going to talk about the three experiments. This is the hot cereal experiment that we did on wheat. Gary Wall is going to be talking about that a little bit more, where these are the plots out here that are heated. What, 3 minutes? Okay. This is the one on soy face. This is the one on the range grasses. I picked a week of data from each of the different locations, windy, humid, dry, and rather still here in Maricopa. Here's kind of the results of how well I'm doing. This is the canopy minus air temperature. And you can see that not doing real, real bad. The one case, the red ones are the heated plots, and the blue ones, of course, are the reference plots, with the dots being measurements and the solid lines being the predicted. Now, if we move on to the actual temperature difference and plot it this way, in Maricopa and doing a really quite good job, pretty poor in soy face, and pretty good again in the prairie conditions. If we go to the actual amount of electric power I'm predicting to conduct this experiment, you can see not too bad a job but doing the predicting in Maricopa, and actually pretty good job, I think, in all of them. So I'm confident that at least at the small degrees of warming that we're doing in these experiments, it's not doing too bad. This is it's a plot of the actual performance of the heating system in Maricopa. This is the daytime temperature difference. This is our target. This is what we got. Same at night. It's a skewed thing, but in the mode, we're doing real well. Gary will show you some slides showing the average is a little bit less, which you'd kind of expect. I also compared the measured versus, which is the control signal going back out to the heaters, versus my theory versus what the power company said it would be. And I'm less than what the power company said it would be, but based on the signal going out there in that way, not doing real, real bad. Could do better, but not doing too bad. So anyway, there's my conclusions. They performed very well in these three experiments. I can predict performance quite well in all of them, really. Soy face, I could really do a lot better yet, but anyway, not too bad, but getting better, I hope. So we'll let it go at that. Thank you for your attention.